And then, because they were so worldly and had committed so many sins, they will be made to enter the painful punishment of hell. So altogether, in this blessed and very sacred and very noble tradition and hadith, we see that Imam Ali alayhi salam has mentioned three groups of people. Some people's actions will be taken account for, and they will, but their account will be easy. It will not be difficult for them. They will enter paradise. The second is the group of people whose actions will not be taken account for, and they will automatically enter paradise. So these two groups of people enter paradise. One group of them is taken account for, the other is not. And finally is the group who is not even taken account for. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the categories of people in the hereafter, in the words of Imam Ali. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Mass murder after mass murder describes the reality of what the Israeli regime is committing on a daily basis in Gaza. Since October, the U.S. Israeli genocide has claimed over 34,000 victims, and the number is most likely over 40,000. As hard as it is to believe, some of the worst atrocities have been committed in places that are usually off limits during war, but obviously, that is not the case with this Holocaust against Palestinians. Hospitals, that's right, hospitals, have been one of the favorite targets of the regime. Why? Stay with us as we take a look at this and more on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Vancouver. And David William Parrott, academic author and journalist out of Scotland. Well, thank you both for being with us. I'm going to start this off with Charlotte. Charlotte, hospital after hospital in Gaza has witnessed major destruction and harm, mass murder, torture, and arrests have taken place at these facilities. Why do you think that hospitals have been one of the main targets of the Zionist regime in Gaza?
When you think about genocide, what we're fundamentally talking about is an attempt to exterminate a population, to rid an area of its people, of its population. And so this genocide in Palestine, of course, we've seen the horrendous crimes of the past 6 months against the Palestinian people in Gaza, but there's been a Zionist genocide against the Palestinian people for over 75 years now. And of course, if you want to take away people's right and ability to live, if you want to take away the fundamental parts of infrastructure that enable people to survive, that enable people to recover from the damage inflicted by this war machine that targets the most vulnerable, people with disabilities, elderly people, children and infants, then what do? You target hospitals and you target healthcare facilities. And what we have seen has been the systematic and deliberate targeting of hospitals and healthcare facilities while engaging in an international propaganda campaign to supposedly legitimize the targeting, bombing, besieging and destruction of Palestinian healthcare facilities throughout Gaza. We saw it at Al-Shifa Hospital through two sieges, two series of attacks, two series of mass arrests, two series of mass graves. We saw it at Al-Nasser Hospital. We're seeing it at Al-Awda Hospital now, which was once again targeted just yesterday in Nusayrat camp. All of this is meant to make Gaza unlivable. It is meant to make Palestinians die or force them to leave their land. And one of the things that has really just stood out is the incredible bravery of Palestinian healthcare workers in resisting this genocide.
Yeah, really. Well, David, mass graves have now been discovered in the yard of the Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, and the bodies of 283 medical staff, patients, and refugees who were taking shelter at the hospital have been discovered. I mean, shouldn't there be extreme outrage throughout the world, at least when doctors and patients have been targeted?
Do you know, your question almost beggars belief. I mean, the situation almost beggars belief. Firstly, let me do some polite protocols. It's a pleasure to meet Charlotte. It's an honor to be on your show.
Thank you for coming.
The pleasure is mine. You know, I'm not sure I'm the right person, to be honest. I'm a lifelong peacenik, a pacifist through and through, who's, I suppose, used to other types of engagement. You know, this type of warfare is something new to me, and I'm not claiming to be any type of expert on Sun Tzu or, you know, how warfare is waged. But when hospitals are targeted, I mean, there was a big hoo-ha in the international press at the start. Were they being targeted or not? I think it's quite clear to see now that they are, and it's unacceptable, really. You know, even if some of these facilities are being used, you know, with the intention of shielding fighters, and again, that's questionable, I don't think in this day and age that's an excuse. There are ways to find that out. There are ways around those problems. Any war on civilians is an outrage. It's terrible. You know, I'm here this evening to speak for peace, the ordinary Palestinian, and maybe also the ordinary Israeli, you know, who have been drawn into this situation. And everybody seems incapable of getting us out of it. I don't believe it myself. I think with a bit of goodwill and initiative, remembering the values that we all share, you know, I think humanity can reassert itself before it's too late.
Okay, well, Charlotte, I mean, when we look at the absolute absence of humanity by the Zionist regime, I mean, do you think that part of the barbarism we're witnessing is due to its total military and intelligence failure on October 7th and since then?
I think that's absolutely the case. What happened on the 7th of October was that the Palestinian resistance, I mean, in ways that built upon what the Lebanese resistance had done before, in ways that built on Palestinian resistance that has been ongoing throughout the history of Zionist colonization in Palestine, would show the possibility that the Palestinian armed resistance had the capacity to defeat the so-called undefeatable Zionist army, and that there was the potential to imagine a Palestine that was free of Zionism and a region that was free of U.S. imperialism. That is what happened on October 7th. All of the outrage, all of the shouts and screams, not only from the Zionists, but from, you know, world officials, you know, U.S. President Biden, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Olaf Scholz of Germany, Macron in France, all of these imperialist powers denouncing and decrying October 7th in the strongest of terms. I mean, because of the fact that October 7th was presenting material manifestation of the fact that, in fact, the Zionist project can be defeated. And that defeat that looks closer than ever. And the freedom of Palestine looks closer than ever. And so the Zionist regime and the imperialist powers responded the way that they always do to a rising of people seeking justice and seeking freedom from years of exploitation and domination. And that is through genocide, bombing, and massacres of civilians. They have not effectively targeted, nor have they effectively undermined the Palestinian resistance and its military capacity. They are not capable of stopping the resistance in Lebanon. They're not capable of stopping it in Yemen, and they are certainly not capable of stopping it in Iran. And they are instead attempting to win a pseudo victory through massacring civilians and bombing hospitals, schools, mosques, churches, and residential buildings. But of course, this is no victory at all. The humanity of the world is being defended by those who are part of the camp of resistance in the region and around the world. And it is in those examples, in the Palestinian resistance fighters and the people of Yemen stopping the ships from resupplying genocide, in the Lebanese resistance emptying northern Palestine of soldiers and settlers, and of course in the retaliatory actions by Iran that are actually defending humanity against the rapacious attacks of Zionism and imperialism today.
Okay. Well, David, the first operation on a hospital during this genocide in Gaza was at the Al-Ahli Arab Hospital back in October. Now, during that onslaught, initially the regime tried to deny that it committed the crime. Now, so many hospitals have been targeted, and it doesn't even bother trying to explain the horror it is creating. I mean, what does it say about the regime in general and about the progression of this genocide?
Zionism's a strange beast in all sorts of ways. You know, I wonder if we're looking at the various rafts of Zionism coming apart, religious Zionism, political Zionism, which of course does not represent all the people of Israel and indeed all of the views that come out of Israel. I can't get over the fact a hospital was targeted in the first place. I remember reeling with shock when I first heard that news. In the evening, I posted it on my social media immediately saying, what has the world come to? I lost a couple of friends, Jewish friends. I hadn't accused anybody of anything at that particular time. And you think, you know, there are standards, common human standards, standards of decency that we throw away at our peril. I mean, it strikes me at the moment that international law is collapsing around our ears. You know, the order and structure of things after World War II, which was rightly put in place to try and make us all just a little more civilized, is literally coming apart at the seams. As you said yourself a minute ago, hospitals, churches, I mean, where does it all stop? We can't weaponize everything and remain human. I mean, one of the interesting facts, I think, about Zionism is, of course, there was an influx of Russian Zionists not too long ago. I don't think they're the most faith-driven people in the world. I mean, I remember seeing some interviews, reading about some interviews where they actually laughed at the idea of faith in Israel. Forgive me for painting in such broad brushstrokes. I don't have the figures and names in front of me, though I can get them. You know, and you think, well, okay, what is left if you're not fighting for that type of Israel? You're fighting for something artificial and you're fighting for something that really has little mercy on the surrounding people. I mean, I've had friends in Palestine for years. A friend of mine was the wife of a vicar. They all lived in Palestine together. And I can't remember the book she wrote offhand. It was charming. You know, how before the State of Israel was established, everyone would go to each other's church, each other's mosque, each other's synagogue, and celebrate the seasonal rites together. All that has fallen apart. And now we're going to a new level of hospitals being attacked, sacred sites being attacked, graveyards being cleared. For me, I suppose that's one of the ultimate signs that humanity's gone out the window. The complete rubbing away of somebody's culture. It can't continue. What surprises me most is the aggression, I suppose, on the part of America and its proxy Israel in this particular instance. You know, there's a belligerence that I haven't known for a long, long time. It's depressing to see, and the complete lack of willing to discuss these issues is absolutely terrifying. You know, you're either for us or against us. The whole Biden regime, you know, that man can't get his head out of 1950s America. The world has moved on. You're either for us or you're against us. This simply isn't human. It's not rational, and it won't lead to peace. If I've got anything to say this evening on your wonderful show, is that we've got to find ways to reach peace. Further killings, further murders, further atrocities will not help anybody. And that's my view.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Charlotte, I mean, the regime has not reached any of its military goals in Gaza, nor was its intelligence able to prevent the Hamas October 7th operation. I mean, what does this say about the true abilities of the regime? Because it always tried to portray this invincibility in the region and throughout the world.
I think it shows that, you know, the Zionist regime is not invincible. The Zionist regime has never been invincible. It has relied on the weaponry provided by imperialism and its backing and support by Britain, the United States, France, Germany, etc., in order to maintain an image, a false image of dominance in the region. And that dominance has been established purely by having access to weaponry and technical support. I mean, we just saw the United States Congress voting to send another $26 billion in weaponry to the Zionist war machine carrying out a genocide. But the Palestinian people are the indigenous people of the land, rooted in the land, refusing to give up, refusing to bow down. I mean, the heroic action of October 7th was a statement that the Palestinian people will not be imprisoned, will not be subject to siege, and that Palestine will be free from the river to the sea. That's not just a slogan, but that's a reality. And that reality is going to be accomplished by all means that are necessary, including and led by the armed resistance, and in alliance with all of the resistance forces and peoples in the region. And this is something that is becoming more and more clear. And so we're seeing this absolutely genocidal conduct and targeting of every aspect of civilian life by a wounded beast, a regime that knows it has no future in Palestine and it has no future in the region. And October 7th was only the beginning of a new era of Palestinian revolution. It was only a manifestation of the fact that the balance of power in the world is changing, and that massacring civilians en masse and carrying out mass executions and the slaughters of children and healthcare workers and people is not going to maintain this unjust, illegitimate colonial settler project in occupied Palestine. It's simply not going to be able to do so. And they're not going to be able to rely on their weaponry in order to do so. Every single weekend, we see millions of people around the world in the streets for Palestine. Right now, we're seeing some of the most prestigious university campuses in the United States, where there is a student uprising going on, an occupation of campus, saying that we're not going to stop doing this until this university divests from the Zionist regime. This is a manifestation of the fact that people, even the people of the imperial court, do not want to be associated with Zionism, do not want to be associated with racism, do not want to be part of this war machine anymore. And so it's up to us to continue to take action, to support those who are making those changes on the ground, led by the resistance forces, in order to bring an end to this genocide and bring an end to these crimes against humanity. There's a reason why the Columbia occupation and the Gaza Solidarity Encampment is getting so much support, because it's showing that every sector of society is done with genocide, done with Zionism, okay, and it has no future.
Well, David, what about Charlotte's comments? Because it just seems, you know, when we look at just basic humanity, after watching this, it's almost been now 200 days. Tomorrow will be the 200th day since this genocide has begun, that people, normal people, just cannot take looking at this and tolerating this day after day. And that's why we're seeing more and more actions in university campuses. Even people take the risk of being suspended from the university, losing their jobs. But I feel that growing like just everyone is willing to do whatever they can, and they feel responsible to be able to try to do something to stop this genocide. I mean, your thoughts on that side of things?
You have to remember that huge marches are taking place across the United Kingdom every weekend at the minute to put a stop to this perceived inhumanity. You know, what am I perceiving personally? The shades of colonialism, the shades of racism, you know, all the things that dragged Europe down from its quite glorious heritage at one point. All of those old nasty colonial attitudes that are creeping into the discourse, creeping into attitudes, and, you know, we have to extricate ourselves from that because it's done by a ruling elite in Britain and maybe elsewhere too that have vested interests in keeping the status in the quo, which, of course, isn't working. Despite what the Prime Minister says, a lot of people are very angry and very upset. You know, and they know. I mean, I can barely myself watch the images on TV. I can hardly look at them. But I know from some journalist friends of mine that they, you know, these are watered down images. They're not really showing the horror of the realities. You know, a young mother, a young lady with half of her hand shot away. A young toddler, you know, 3 years old, holding his tummy to keep his innards inside. And I remember saying to my journalist friends a couple of weeks ago, well, you know, obviously there are certain protocols, there are certain ways of dealing with reportage, but why isn't any of that being shown here? And they said they don't know themselves. And it's almost like there's a manipulation. Maybe there is a manipulation on what can be said and the way it can be said on the part of media outlets.
Mm.
You know, the idea was, I mean, I'm sorry for going on too long. You know, was a couple of complaints by my friends who'd better remain nameless at the moment. Was sent in to some very senior journalists heading certain departments at the BBC and getting the message back. This isn't evening time viewing. This isn't viewing for ordinary folks when they're having their supper. I can barely believe the inanity and the inhumanity of that as a response. But that is what is happening here. The careful management of a situation and what we learn and what we hear about the atrocities.
Right. Well, of course, Charlotte, I mean, what David's mentioning is something that has been going on for decades as far as manipulating public perspective. But we don't have very much time. I just want to go to the next question. The head of the Israeli military intelligence has been forced to step down due to the failure of the regime on October 7th. Now, his resignation is the first of what is likely to be a long list of forced resignations or firings. Your thoughts about that, Charlotte?
One of the things that we've seen is that one of the reasons why Netanyahu is determined to keep this genocide going is because he doesn't want to be held accountable for the fact that he and his fascist government oversaw one of the greatest military defeats that the Zionist regime has suffered in the past 75 years. He doesn't want to take accountability for that, and he doesn't want to take accountability for the fact that every single day the Palestinian resistance is continuing to snipe their soldiers and destroy their tanks, and despite all of their genocidal TikToks that they post, the Zionist military is not achieving victory. In fact, it's being defeated every day by the Palestinian people and their resistance, and for that matter, by Yemen and Lebanon, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and all of the forces of resistance in the region that are coming together to expose the weakness. As they say, that the Zionist regime is like a spider's web. Its weakness is being exposed every single day, and they want to hang on to their power with genocide, bombings, and war crimes, and it's up to us to do everything that we can to make sure that they're not able to get away with that.
Well, David, I mean, from so many aspects, the regime seems to be imploding economically, politically, militarily. How do you see it?
It's certainly being propped up by America at the minute, which is outrageous. And, you know, it's got to this stage in America, according to my contacts, that even to side, you know, with the downtrodden, even to side with your ordinary Palestinian now makes you tantamount to a terrorist. I mean, this is ridiculous. I was being told the other day by some friends of mine who were protesters over there, humanitarians and pacifists, that all they were doing was going up to senators, on their way to their offices, maybe, you know, representatives, and saying, what are we doing as American citizens to bring some balance and to bring some sanity into this situation. And they were told they were terrorists. They were Islamic terrorists. They were Palestinian terrorists. I mean, the first thing we have to do is bring proportionality back into what we're saying to each other, a little bit of sanity into each other. And I can't, with each other, I can't help feeling really that's one of the things that the right-wing regime of Netanyahu really doesn't want. I agree 100% that its failings and its weaknesses are being exhibited every day now. But, the almighty power of America is going to keep it going for a very long time unless enough people say enough is enough and we start seeing things in their true light. You know, human beings are suffering without any real need. They're being starved. Malnutrition is being weaponized. Aid isn't getting through. I know it depends on what part of Palestine you're in, but let's face it, overall, aid isn't getting through. And we've just simply got to say to Netanyahu's regime, enough is enough. You can hold back the inevitable for a certain amount of time, but not forever.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me here on the Spotlight. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, Samadun Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network out of Vancouver, and David William Perry, academic, author, and journalist out of Scotland. And thank you for staying with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Faith and Life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You are listening to A to Z and we want to talk about faith and life. Well, first of all, we should understand what is a faith in Quranic understanding. Quran uses the word Iman for faith. Well, what is the meaning of Iman? Iman comes from the verb Amana. It means to protect something, to give peace and protection to something, to make something in a condition where it is protected and it is in peace. That is the meaning of the root Iman, to make something be in protection and peace. So, and what does Iman mean in this context? What is the Quranic concept of faith in Islamic tradition and Islamic understanding? Well, faith is actually, Iman is actually to make a belief, to make an idea deep-rooted in your heart. Well, there are ideas which are not deep-rooted in your heart. When an idea becomes deep-rooted in your heart, now you protect it from doubt. You protect it from skepticism, being skeptical about it. So protecting something from doubt is making it deep-rooted in your heart. So you no more doubt it. You are no more skeptical about it. This is Iman. Iman means to make something deeply rooted in your heart so you no more doubt it, or it is protected from the doubt or any type of intellectual skepticism or doubt. So this is Iman. So this is one type and one aspect of Iman, that you make something deeply rooted in your heart that you no more doubt it based on the evidence and rational proofs. Welcome back. You are listening to A to Z and we are talking about faith or Iman and the life. Well, as we talked earlier, that faith or Iman in Quranic understanding means to grow an idea deep so that the idea becomes deeply ingrained and rooted in your heart. That is called Iman, when it is protected from doubts. Now, this is the one aspect of Iman. You protected an idea from being victim of doubt and skepticism. On the other aspect, it does not become Iman. It's not possible for you to make an idea deeply rooted in your heart without acting according to the practical implications of that idea. So, Iman has twofold existence in ourselves. First is when something is deeply rooted in your heart, so you no more doubt it and you are not skeptical about it, so you protected it. Amana, you protected it. This is Iman. Now the second aspect is if something is deeply rooted in your heart, the result of it, you will not violate that idea in the practice. So here also, you are doing the practice of Iman, you are actually protecting the idea, you are actually protecting that thought from being violated in practice. So if someone says, I have Iman in God, I believe in God, it actually means that first of all, I have deeply rooted this idea in my heart, so I no more doubt it. I have no any skeptical stance about this idea because I have actually rationally and intellectually reached at certainty about this point. And in the second aspect, you said not only that it has reached and deeply rooted in my heart, I do not violate this idea in my practice. And that is the real and true Iman. So Iman is actually believing deeply in something and not to violate its practical implication. I may ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He may help us to achieve Iman in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala truly.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As Iran marks the anniversary of the failed U.S. military operation in the central Tabas Desert, people in the country say the Sands were the agents of God. A memorial ceremony was held in the capital, Tehran, with the event highlighting the budged American operation in which U.S. choppers crashed in the desert.
On April 24, 1980, the U.S. military carried out a cover operation in Iran by the order of President Jim Carter. The operation, dubbed Eagle's Claw, failed due to major sandstorms in the central Tabas Desert. The failed operation resulted in the death of American soldiers. Iranians believe the Sands were the agents of God.
The botched American mission was an attempt to release 52 staff of the U.S. Embassy, known as the Den of Espionage, who had been held after the 1979 Islamic Revolution.
The incident of Tabas was a helping hand from the Almighty God to defend the great nation of Iran. And also the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, said the Sands were appointed by God. Even the Sands rose in support of the Iranian nation. And that bitter incident happened to the American regime.
Unlike the previous years, this year's memorial isn't just a history lesson. It is also an opportunity to reflect on Iran's recent anti-Israel retaliatory attack, dubbed Operation True Promise, which showed the true power of Iran's military forces. Since the failed U.S. Operation Eagle Claw, Iran has boosted and upgraded its defense capabilities and can now stand up to all kinds of threats.
And civilians will not hesitate to retaliate from our own land. The True Promise operation was executed in a specific manner which is classified right now. We used scores of drones, crews, and ballistic missiles with proper timing to successfully penetrate the complicated Israeli air defense systems and strike our targets with pinpoint accuracy.
Iran has shown that threats from its enemies have only strengthened its will to defend what belongs to the nation. And now, it seems that the West has woken up to Iran's military powers after Operation True Promise. Reza Hashemi, Tehran.
A recent United Nations report predicts that approximately 16 million individuals in Afghanistan will be struggling to gain access to food this year. To get a better understanding of the situation, we visited a family in Kabul facing acute food shortages. The Rukhshana family's daily struggle mirrors the difficulties faced by countless households across the country.
I lost my husband during the war in our hometown. I don't have a male provider and I can't find a source of income. One of my grandkids polishes boots, but that is not enough for our family. It has been a long time since the last time we had rice and potatoes in our home. We barely eat two meals a day, which is stale breads and tea. My children are asking for soup and I feel so bad as I can't make it for them.
Our situation here is so difficult that we can hardly survive. It is because there is no income or food to eat. If we eat during the day, we should sleep with empty stomachs at night. There are people who skip meals to feed their children. Some families beg for food but fail to find some because almost no one has a better situation. We used to receive some aid from the United Nations World Food Program, but now it is gone and has left people to their fate.
According to the UN report, the Afghan population cannot fulfill essential needs, including health care, food, employment, and shelter. Some local experts argue that the current hardships faced by Afghans stem from prolonged foreign interventions and conflicts, suggesting that those involved bear a responsibility to aid in the crisis resolution.
I think all the misery and economic hardships that Afghans are going through today stem from the shameful U.S.-West intervention and wars in Afghanistan. If they had let us build constructive economic relations with our neighbors, we would not be so broken today. The U.S. and its allies are responsible because they came and destroyed our infrastructure here, and on the other hand, they imposed economic sanctions after their withdrawal. Today, they cannot turn a blind eye on what they have created.
As the international community's attention shifts away from Afghanistan and the foreign aid continues to shrink, the Afghan people still hope for a means of survival that will pull them back from the edge of crisis. Millions of Afghans are facing emergency levels of food insecurity and malnutrition. The UN agencies warn that the situation is expected to worsen rapidly if urgent action are not taken by the global community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
G20
During the second day of his official visit, the Iranian president displayed a keen focus on strengthening cultural bonds with Pakistan. Traveling to Lahore, a city with rich cultural heritage, President Raisi was warmly welcomed upon his arrival by the Chief Minister of Punjab, Mariam Nawaz. He paid homage at the mausoleum of the revered Urdu and Persian poet Allama Muhammad Iqbal. Iqbal is held high esteem in Iran for his poetic works in the Persian language and is lovingly called Iqbal-e-Lahori by the Iranians. President Raisi emphasized that there was no sense of foreignness in Pakistan, underlining the deep historical and cultural connections between the two nations. President Raisi offered special prayers for the oppressed people of Gaza and lauded the Pakistani nation for its unwavering unity in championing the rights of oppressed people of Palestine. Meanwhile, the president paid a visit to the renowned University of Lahore and delivered a speech. In his address, President Raisi emphasized the deep historical, religious, cultural, and civilizational bonds between Pakistan and Iran. Raisi also said the common point of view of the people of Iran and Pakistan is the defense of the oppressed Palestinian nation. He asserted that the Islamic Republic will continue to defend the resistance and oppressed nation of Palestine with pride. President Raisi also warned that if Israel makes a mistake and attacks Iran's territory, it is clear that nothing will be left of the Israeli regime. Later, during consecutive meetings with the Chief Minister and Governor of Punjab, the Iranian President reassured Pakistani authorities of Tehran's commitment to collaborating in bolstering cultural and trade relations between the two nations.
President Raisi has devoted his second day of Pakistan visit to exploring the country's rich cultural heritage. Many believe that the Iranian President's trip will significantly contribute to boosting the bilateral trade and strengthening cultural relations between the two nations. Nasir Kazmi, Lahore.
Dozens of organizations marched in Paris against Islamophobia and racism as Israel's attempted genocide and ethnic cleansing has caused increased state-sponsored repression against Europe's largest Muslim community. A main theme of the march was protecting children. Since October 7th, children as young as 10 years old have been charged with so-called apology for terrorism, while a child of 8 was falsely targeted for praying during recess. Scandals like those have many saying that non-white children are no longer being treated like children, but instead like suspected fanatics, delinquents, and full-grown adults.
We Muslims are enduring so much Islamophobia these days, and it's not like there wasn't a lot of Islamophobia in France already. The targeting of our children is a step too far, and it's incredible that they've taken this shameful step.
As France is accused of targeting Muslim children at home, their elite are giving military and political cover to Israel's mass murder in Gaza of an estimated 15,000 children and the orphaning of some 20,000 others.
On les bombarde.
It's totally unjust how we are watching murder, torture, and the bombing of embassies, and nobody is allowed to say anything. We're here to say, stop the violence against Palestinian and Iranian people.
A decade ago, during another Israeli invasion of Gaza, France became the first country to ever ban pro-Palestinian demonstrations. They banned pro-Palestinian demonstrations for a month after the counterattack by Hamas on October 7th, handing out hundreds of thousands of euros in fines and making mass arrests. Police initially banned this march, claiming it was a threat to public order and possibly anti-Semitic. That was overturned at the last moment, but many say the effort is proof of a long-running double standard against non-whites and non-Jews.
C'est des antisémites. Ça, c'est n'importe quoi.
Anytime there is a march about Palestine or Islamophobia, the interior minister in whatever administration seeks to ban it. The idea that we are anti-Semitic is total nonsense. I get the feeling that I'm more French than many others who aren't of Algerian descent, as I am, because many have totally abandoned the longtime values of French political culture.
Similar to during France's 2-year state of emergency starting in November 2015, many have been shocked by the lack of outcry at this latest targeting of the Muslim community, despite perpetual bragging of being the alleged birthplace of human rights. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
After almost 3 days, the Israeli forces withdrew from the refugee camp of Nur Shams near the city of Tul Karim in northern occupied West Bank. Only then paramedics were able to evacuate the martyrs' bodies and the families were able to count their dead. Over a dozen Palestinians have been killed since Thursday, but the number might be higher, as reports suggest that Israeli forces had confiscated the bodies of more martyrs. On Sunday, a comprehensive general strike was declared across the occupied West Bank to mourn Tul Karim martyrs. Scores of Palestinians also held a protest in the center of Ramallah against Israel's escalation and violence in Tul Karim and Nur Shams refugee camp.
Israel is expanding its genocide into the West Bank as well. And as we said before, there is no safe place for any Palestinian. And there has to be immediate Palestinian unity to stand up to this terrible aggression. And there has to be international boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign worldwide. And there has to be condemnation.
It's obvious that the Palestinian people, leadership and factions have to declare an immediate comprehensive popular uprising all over the Palestinian territories until the Israeli occupation ends. The ongoing war of attrition is no longer useful, but what's necessary is a national popular uprising.
The Israeli invasion has caused some of the worst destruction in the West Bank in decades. The occupation forces destroyed infrastructure, including sewage lines, shops, homes, and vehicles. Homes were turned into interrogation centers, and dozens of Palestinians were arrested. According to locals, heavy exchange of fire and clashes took place between resistance fighters and Israeli soldiers during the operation. The Israeli military admitted that at least 9 of its soldiers were wounded.
The Israeli occupation regime is escalating its violence against the Palestinian people. Its crimes are meant to exterminate the Palestinian people. In Gaza, genocide is being committed, and here in the West Bank, there are daily incursions, murders, collective punishment, and destruction everywhere. The Israeli occupation is doing its utmost to either bring Palestinians to their knees or commit more aggression and crimes against them.
Sunday's general strike paralyzed all aspects of life in the West Bank, with shops, schools, universities, and banks shuttered. But Palestinians question whether such a standstill is enough, expressing fear that once the Israeli military is done with Gaza, the occupied West Bank could be next. The Israeli military's violence against Palestinians is aimed at countering resistance, people here say. This is part of the Israeli crackdown on armed groups in the occupied West Bank. However, Palestinians say the Israeli crimes, including in the Nur Shams refugee camp, have failed to weaken their determination. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
A two-day international forum dubbed What Future for Palestine kicked off in Rome on Saturday. The initiative, organized by an opposition group called Front of Dissent, has been put together to tackle different topics, namely Zionism, its impact on Palestine and West Asia, the nature of Israel, what changes for the Palestinian resistance after October 7, West Asia in its transition to a multipolar world, and the risk of the Ukraine war escalating into a global conflict. The conference was attended by citizens who are very concerned about the turn the situation has taken in Western countries.
Today's forum is an important attempt to break down the wall of silence surrounding Zionist wrongdoings in West Asia. It is appalling how our mainstream media are covering Israel's brutal war in Gaza. They have created a parallel world and a parallel truth with the aim of covering up the bad things Israel is doing.
The superpowers that support Zionism are former colonial powers, most of them. And they had a role in creating Zionism in the first place. Many people allowed the Zionists to really empower themselves So they were originally empowered by people who probably had a sense of guilt about the Holocaust, but eventually they became so powerful that they are able to control so many media outlets. They are able to control many politicians.
Speakers at the conference included former diplomats, politicians, journalists and activists from several countries, including China, the US, Britain, Russia and many others. Video links were also established with the spokesman for the worldwide anti-Zionist religious group, Neturei Karta International. Analysts at the conference are saying that the aftershocks of the Gaza crisis triggered by Israeli genocidal war are highly likely to reach far beyond West Asia and the Africa region, with the US credibility as a regional security guarantor shot to pieces. West Asia might see increased diplomatic engagement from China and Russia.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan received the head of the Hamas political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, in Istanbul. During the meeting that lasted for more than 2.5 hours, the two sides discussed the Israeli aggression on Gaza, ways and measures to ensure uninterrupted and sufficient delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza, and the lasting peace in the West Asia region. During the meeting, President Erdogan stated that amid ongoing tensions in the region, it is important to keep the world's attention on Gaza and not allow the Israeli regime to achieve political gains from its standoff with Iran. In a statement published by the Turkish presidency, Erdogan said, "It is vital that Palestinians act with unity in this process. The strongest response to Israel and the path to victory lie in unity and integrity."
Today's meeting was very important for both Turkey and Hamas to set ground for the upcoming changes. We all know now Qatar is hosting Hamas Bureau and leaders as well as playing the role of mediator in negotiations with Israel. While there is a pressure from Washington for Hamas to leave Qatar, and there is the question of where will Hamas go now, we know that the relation of Hamas and Syria is getting better, and it already has a good relation with Iran. But I don't think they are a choice, and for that, Turkey will be the best option.
Analysts say Turkey will not only be hosting Hamas movement leaders and bureau, but will also take the lead in mediating to reach a lasting solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
Turkey is trying to play a very important role that is bigger than working on reaching a ceasefire in Gaza. It is rather solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and trying to reach a lasting solution. The 7th of October was a turning point to start working on reaching a lasting solution, and I think Turkey's role is a key for it to maintain good relations with all sides.
Hamas had an office in Turkey since 2011, and Turkey mediated in exchange of prisoners. Turkish president maintains warm relations with Haniyeh and says he will always defend the Palestinian cause. Today's meeting takes place against the backdrop of Qatar potentially stepping back from ceasefire talks. This development could create a vacancy that Ankara is well positioned to fill, given Turkey's established relations, particularly with the Hamas movement, which many view as a strategic advantage. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
In the limelight.
Unless a ceasefire is called, it appears certain that Gaza's hospitals and medical workers will be subjected to further attacks, that disease will spread, and that more people will die from conditions that are both preventable and curable. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Reem Omar is worried about the health of her family. Two of her four children have contracted hepatitis. The first sign of infection came when Reem noticed that her daughter's face had turned a sickly shade of yellow. After a few days, her daughter, who had become quite thin, had a high temperature and diarrhea and started to vomit. Reem initially sought help from Medical Point. Its workers felt a more thorough examination was necessary and told Reem that her daughter should be taken to the Kobeti Hospital in Rafah, Gaza's southernmost city. Hepatitis A is closely associated with poor diet and a lack of clean water. Reem is convinced that the scarcity of food in Gaza caused her children to become ill. She said, "There are no fruit or healthy sources of nutrition that help children and adults to fight diseases." Following mass displacement, more than 1 million people remain crammed into Rafah, despite reports that some have recently left the city. Jamal Alhams, a doctor at the Kuwaiti hospital, noted that displaced people are living in very difficult conditions and there is no protection from viruses and epidemics. He said, "We used to receive 100 patients a day in this small and simple hospital. Today, we are talking about receiving 1,000 or more patients with infectious diseases during a single day, not to mention the many cases of injuries because of the ongoing war on Gaza. The few remaining hospitals in Gaza are overwhelmed. The Zionist regime has been attacking the healthcare system without mercy." The World Health Organization has described the situation as heartbreaking. Among the sites targeted are Ashrafa, Gaza's largest hospital. Last month, the Zionist regime carried out one of the worst massacres in Palestinian history there. Within the past few days, a mass grave has been found at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza. It contained at least 180 bodies. Unless a ceasefire is called, it appears certain that Gaza's hospitals and medical workers will be subjected to further attacks, that disease will spread, and that more people will die from conditions that are both preventable and curable. Meanwhile, the website of the New Arab wrote, "Hundreds of cases of respiratory illnesses have been reported in the Gaza Strip, the territory's civil defense said recently, attributing the rise to Gazans resorting to cooking over firewood due to cooking gas shortages. In a statement, the civil defense said that families across the war-hit territory, particularly Gaza City and other northern parts, have resorted to cooking with plastic utensils over firewood and charcoal over the past 6 months, emitting poisonous gas, as reported by Anadolu Agency. The Gaza Strip has long suffered from cooking gas and fuel shortages as a result of the Zionist regime's ongoing blockade of the coastal enclave since 2007. Shortages have been further exacerbated by Tel Aviv's brutal military onslaught on the Gaza Strip, as well as its total siege, depriving residents of basic essentials such as food, water, and fuel. Aid has trickled into the territory in insufficient quantities with severe shortages persisting, particularly in the north of the territory. The statement read, The Israeli occupation's continued prevention of the entry of cooking gas into the Gaza Strip, especially to Gaza City and the northern Gaza Strip, portends a new humanitarian and health crisis in light of the ongoing aggression against our people. For many months, citizens have been relying on alternative means of lighting fires from wood and charcoal, which has caused many to suffer from respiratory